Thank you all for joining us for part three of this series, Biblical Theology in a Time of Climate Emergency. I wanted in today's session to talk about Psalm 104, otherwise known among Jews as Barchi Nafshi, the Psalm for Rosh Chodesh. So what we have here is this elaborate and expansive and extensive praise of God for creating. And here's the point I want to underscore, because it's sort of a different feel than Genesis 1, not just for creating, but for ongoingly nurturing the creation. This is a God who's very busy, right? You could read Genesis 1 and think, I'm not suggesting this is the only way to read it, or even that it's necessarily the right way to read it. You could read Genesis 1 and think, okay, God made the world, stepped back, kind of took a rest, and now it's sort of like give it over to creation to do its thing. You could not possibly read this psalm that way, right? This psalm imagines that God is involved in daily feeding, and it's just kind of active, if you will, almost managerial, but that's a very kind of mechanical word. So if you can find a better one, I'd be grateful. God's in a kind of like daily nurturance role, you might say. Okay. Richard Baucom, who we've spoken about before in this class, describes this psalm as animated by the entire world as God's gift to all living creatures. All creation in this psalm seems to share a kind of basic, irreducible, elemental, call it whatever you want, dependence on God. And yet, it's worth saying, and we'll see this in just a few moments as we walk through the psalm, the fact that creatures are dependent does not make them passive. Right? I think that that's actually quite important. Birds build their nests. Humans work the land, right? So you can be dependent without being completely passive. There is space in this creation for lions to go hunting for the prey that they're asking God for. That's the kind of the wonderful richness of that image. Now, human beings do seem to get more attention than other living things in this psalm. See, for example, verses 14 and 15, verse 23, verse 26. There are references to animals that are domesticated, to agriculture, to viticulture, to ships that are sailing in the ocean. And yet, and this is a point that Baucom and others emphasize, or at least argue for, the idea that there is no sense in this psalm of human beings being supreme over the other creatures, right? They may get special attention, but there's no sense that they're somehow like elevated above. You certainly don't have the sounds of Genesis 1 here of being kind of God's vice regents. A Bible scholar named James Lindberg, I thought this was interesting, makes the comment that you see this especially through the parallelism in verse 14, in which essentially we say, you make grass grow for cattle and herbage for man's labor, right? Like, you know, we're like, as he puts it, we are equal among equals here rather than supreme among those who are equal to each other, but not equal to us. Or in an image that I really love, my friend, the Bible scholar, Bill Brown, in an essay on this psalm says, I love this formulation, all that distinguishes the lion from the human is that the former takes the night shift while the latter works during the day. I don't know if it's, I'm not quite sure that it's all that distinguishes the lion from the human, but I think the larger thrust there is basically right. Now, one last point by way of introduction here, and then we'll kind of begin to walk through it. Lindberg, he makes a comment that I found helpful here, which is that there are at least two models of imagining the human relationship with the rest of the natural world. I suspect there are more and that there are nuances among these, but he basically uses this language that I wanted to introduce, you know, in our final discussion, the dominion model versus what he calls the integration model. He's borrowing this from other older German Bible scholars, but I think that that's really important. It's important to him to say, please don't forget, because Genesis 1 is the first chapter in the Bible, that it is not the only model of the human relationship to the rest of the natural world. In fact, as he puts it, the integration model runs alongside the dominion model from the very start of the Bible. You could argue that Genesis 2 already, as we saw, has something of a closer to an integration model. Is that clear how I'm using those terms? Right? So this seems to be much closer to a full-on integration model than it does to a dominion model. I don't see, even if there's an element of human uniqueness here, I certainly don't see any element of human supremacy here. Let's for a minute think about the structure of this psalm. I think one could say, I won't belabor this point, but I'll just toss it out there, as some Bible scholars have noted, that verses 1 to 9, you could call creation. Verses 10 to 23, you could call providence, or what I was calling nurturance. And then there's a weaving of the two from verses 24 to 30. I hope that's helpful for those of you kind of glancing at the text. Okay, here in this context, I won't belabor the issue, but nafshi is off in verse 1. It's translated my soul in most of the standard translations. Nefesh really rarely means soul in the Bible, so that's why I translated it as oh my being, as some others do. Barchi nafshi et Hashem, the Common English Bible, for example, says, let my whole being bless the Lord. That feels more right to me. Okay, hod v'hadar, glory and grandeur, those are majesty terms in the Hebrew Bible. So I think there's just a beautiful image to begin with, which is the elements or aspects of the world that God has created, they are the trappings of majesty for God, right? As it were, you know, some kings wear crowns, God has trees, something like that. They are what kind of conveys, captures, embodies, I don't know if the right word here is exactly, the majesty of God. I just also wanted to note, as we move to verse 2, Notesh Shamayim Kayiriah, God who spreads the heavens as if they were like a tent cloth. Just that's kind of a strange image to a lot of people, but I did want to just remind you that you're probably familiar with that. We talk about Shehu Notesh Shamayim V'Yoseid Aretz in Aleinu. Right? That image that God sort of like spreads out the heavens. It's like a garment that God spreads out over the earth. That's the image. Now, here's a really cool thing about that I think is beautiful and that I don't think is homiletical. How's that for a hedge? I don't think this is purely homiletical. The word yiriah, tent cloth, an overwhelming percentage of the times that word is used, it refers to the curtains of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle. And if that is an association that we as readers or daveners are supposed to have, then the kind of implicit image here that we find in other places in the Bible as well is that the world as a whole is a temple for God, right? The world as a whole is a Mishkan. You know, this is kind of a core idea in biblical spirituality and theology. The Mishkan is a microcosm, and the cosmos is a macro temple. There's a kind of right analogy between them. So I sort of just love the use of the word yiriah here. Okay, now in verses 6 to 9, I just sort of feel like we can't talk about this psalm without at least mentioning this, or at least I don't want to. There is a great deal of scholarly discussion about whether this is to be taken as a reference to God's defeat of chaos at the origins of the world, which I think I've spoken about at least a little bit in past sessions, right? And I have to say, having read a whole bunch of scholars on this, I think it remains kind of confusing because on the one hand, it says that God created the primordial waters, which if you think about Genesis 1, for example, the waters were there in the beginning, right? Ve'aretz hayta tohu vavohu, right? There's mayim there, right? God's not making all of it. Here, it seems like God makes the waters and then separates them from the dry land. On the other hand, the language of the waters fleeing from your blast and from the sound of your thunder running away, sure does sound like a storm god defeating the sea. Meaning, There's one way to read these verses where an old biblical motif has been domesticated, right? Like, no, now the waters are stuff that God made. And that will fit with that one of the most incredible images, which I don't know if you caught, but I will get there. The idea that the Leviathan was made by God to play with for sport. I mean, that just takes classic, terrifying imagery and says, yeah, all of that is domesticated now. We're almost moving in a monotheistic direction here. I don't mean to sound like a heretic, but like it's like God is more and more kind of just the maker of it all. And yet it does feel to me like there are vestiges at minimum here of a defeat of chaos. And by the way, that's not just like, that's interesting and random. It sort of actually has massive implications for how, for example, we think about why there is evil in the world, right? If God is not fully omnipotent, if there's primordial chaos that God has to wrestle with, then, okay, so, you know, God's not making it. I mean, that raises obvious other theological problems. But as the history of philosophy attests, the moment you say God is fully omnipotent and the creator of all, well, then you have the problem of then where does evil come from, right? So there's actually like interesting theological implications to what you think the creation story behind this psalm is. So then we move to verse 10, where I think something interesting is happening here, where waters that were once an image of, and actually like a source of chaos, waters are now taken by God and turned into springs that sort of like, you know, flow between hills. In other words, God's power and care have turned what was a threat into a source of sustenance, right? All of a sudden, instead of storms that threaten to undermine the world and make it inhabitable by humans, you have water that is going and watering and feeding what needs to be fed. It's actually kind of a very, I'm now going to make up a word that doesn't exist in English and shouldn't. It is a kind of gentlifying of the image of water, right? It is water becomes here much more gentle than we might be usually tempted to think. As one German Bible scholar puts it, the deadly water chaos has become a fountain of life, right? That's the kind of image that we have here. It's also striking, not surprising, but just worth noting, for example, in these verses 11 and 12, that God brings sustenance and nurture, not just to sort of animals that human beings domesticate and play with, but to animals everywhere, including in the wild. But I think it's interesting that verse 13 introduces the language of tisbah ha'aretz, that the earth is sated, because, and then in verse 16, actually, that the trees are sated. We often think of humans being the ones who are sated from God's food. The achalta v'savata uveirakta, right? You should eat and be sated and blessed. But here, the earth and the trees are sated too. And the suggestion that I'm hesitantly making is that is a conscious repudiation of anthropocentrism. We are not the only beings whose sating God is invested in. What is going on in verse 15? You have wine, oil, and bread. Now, on one level, these are kind of, as Mark Bretman or Del Berlin point out, the three main crops of the agricultural year: grain for bread, grapes for wine, olives for oil. Wine is associated with pleasure, oil with luxury, all of it made possible by this kind of provision of water by God. Now, Robert Alter says something here that I think is not persuasive, but I wanted to mention it. He wants to read, if you have Hebrew, it'll be kind of clearer why he says this, but he translates the phrase lehatzil panim mishemen not as oil that makes the faith shine, but to make the faith shine brighter than oil. In other words, he is taking may, the prefix may, to mean than, rather than what JPS takes it, which is to mean from. The reason why I think Alter is mistaken here is that, and pardon me for entering the deep depths of obscure land for a minute, in the famous Ugaritic epic Kirta, drought is understood as the absence of bread, wine, and oil. Those seem to be a threesome that go together. And that seems to me to make it very likely that the meaning here is that these are the three things that provided. Like Alter's reading here is, I don't mean this in a derisive way. I hope that's obvious, but it feels like it's a sort of too clever by a half. Man, it's like a very beautiful reading of the Hebrew, but I think in context, it doesn't quite work because the whole idea here, I think, is that God provides these things that are the very antithesis of drought. I hope that is at least somewhat clear. Now, moving on for a minute, I wanted to just call your attention to something. I just think it's striking and worth noting. I don't feel confident that I really know what this means, but I love the fact that the trees are called Atzei Hashem, the trees of the Lord, right? Like, you know, you might think it's someone. Okay, so I just want to sort of note that it's not the people of God here, it's the trees of God. I'm skipping more than I would like to, just so we get further. Verse 21. I want to just draw your attention to the idea here that, or to the reality here, that the picture painted is not idyllic, right? The world's ecology, as described here, is still one in which some animals eat other animals. This is not Genesis 1, which imagines a vegetarian Eden or a vegetarian Earth. I shouldn't say Eden. Or Isaiah 11, which imagines that one day the lion will lie down with the lamb, right? This psalm is not messianic in that way, or not eschatological would be better. It assumes, you know what? Lions eat animals. It reminds me of, you know, I often explain Maimonides' rejection of supernatural messianism. So, you know, if lions lie down with lambs, the lambs should not be surprised when they get eaten, right? I think this psalm accepts that that's sort of like what the world is like, okay? Verse 24, Ma rabu ma'asecha Hashem. I think there's two ways to read this. JPS said how many. I translated how manifold. I think that's different. Manifold is about variety, right? Many is like, oh, there could be 47 trillion lions. But it's not just that, right? It's the manifoldness of creation. It's like, remember what we said about Genesis 1? Liminehem. So many kinds of animals. So many kinds of trees. That's what I suspect is going on here. Something like that. And interestingly, the sheer manifoldness of creation is understood as an expression of wisdom, right? Of God's wisdom, right? Kulam bechokhma astita. You made it all because of your vast wisdom. Divine wisdom, it's almost like the Mishnah in Sanhedrin about human beings. Divine wisdom is not expressed in making many carbon copies of the same thing. Divine wisdom is expressed in the sheer multifariousness of what is made. Okay. Verse 26, as I already indicated before, elsewhere, Leviathan is the great sea monster, see perhaps most famously Psalm 74. Whereas here, as John Levinson in one of his books quotes one of his grad students as describing the Leviathan in Psalm 104 as God's rubber ducky, right? This is the ultimate domestication, of the great sea monster. By the way, I should say that you could read Leviathan Zeyatzarta Lesachekbo to mean two different things. This Leviathan that you made to play with, or this Leviathan you made so that it could play in the water. I have to say, I don't have a linguistic argument. I just like number one much better. It makes it more interesting in terms of the unfolding of biblical ideas. The point here, I think, is that God delights, God makes things, and God's like playing with it, right? This is such an amazing, you know, the Bible's commitment to the idea that God is transcendent, above, not synonymous with the world, and yet like playing with a toy. It's actually something kind of, I think, really amazingly beautiful about it. And it's also worth saying, it's also a very soothing image, meaning this means that the thing ancient Israelites, like so many people around them, were terrified of, the source of chaos, it's okay. It's okay, right? There's a kind of peacefulness here that I think is really interesting. I would also add something that I have not seen scholars say, but that seems sort of obvious to me. The very idea that the same verse talks about ships sailing in the same water as the Leviathan really underscores just how tamed he is, right? Oh, I'm going to take a cruise, but that's where the sea monster lives. No worries. He's an aquatic, you know, he's like a plaything. There's a total kind of total toning down, taking down of the threat of the sea monster, or in more human accessible language to many of us, of the threat of chaos. Verses 27 to 30, just notice God's kind of providential, nurturing care of the world. Here, it is not just the human, as in Genesis 2:7, who is kind of given life by God, breathing breath into him. It is all creatures who have their breath handed to them by God. I think you can even, without exaggerating, see in verse 27 and 28, especially the second part of 28, God feeds the animals by hand. You know, when your kid walks or your grandkid walks into the zoo and feeds the goats, right? And like takes delight when the goat eats out of their hand. That's how the goats are with God, according to this psalm. But it's an amazing image. It's actually really quite beautiful. And also, please hear the Hebrew repetition of kulam, which we heard in 24. Kulam bechokhma asita, you made them all with wisdom, and you also take care of them. It's not just creation, it's active providence. The very point I made at the outset. What makes this feel different to me than Genesis 1? It's not a God who did it and stepped back. It's a God whose work, God gets up in the morning, as it were, and does, you know, sun doesn't get up because God is feeding lions at night and humans by day. But this kind of a God whose job, as it were, is never done. Verses 29 and 30, I think, underscore the point that God is providing not only food, but the breath that makes life possible. At the risk of belaboring this point, in verse 29, Tastir panecha yibahelun, you hide your face, they are terrified. That is an image that elsewhere, familiar to many of you from the daily prayers, Psalm 30, is used to describe human experience. Histarta fanecha hayiti nival. You turned your face away, I was scared. Everyone has that, oh my God, what if God, you know, a bear is like walking in the forest going, oh my God, turns God's face away from me, I'm in trouble. It's a kind of an amazing image, right? You know, all of the, everyone, plants, if God turns away, I'll wither, right? It's like, I just wonder if it's a conscious adaptation of an image that seems so human and says, no, that belongs to the entirety of creation. Now, to the last verses, the last five. I think the idea is sort of kind of gorgeous and spiritually kind of profound. The hope that God will be able to rejoice in God's creation. God, I hope you love this. And as Bill Brown points out, it's so interesting. This is a highly unusual image because it is usually, this is in a way what we saw last week. I'm not sure rejoicing is the word we would use, but we saw the idea that creation, you know, praises God or rejoices in or rejoices in the presence of God. Here it's the reverse. The creator rejoices in what the creator has made, right? The rejoicing goes in the opposite direction. If you look at verse 34, this feels important to me. Ye'erav alav sichi, may my prayer be a source of pleasure to him. Arev is a word that is used for sacrifices. We pray v'arva. Well, I don't know if all Jews these days pray this. V'arva l'Adonai minchat Yerushalayim. May the sacrifices made in Jerusalem smell wonderful to God. And here, right, here's one of them. One of these days I'm going to write something about this. I'm sure someone else has written about this. I just haven't, noticed it. You have a whole bunch of Psalms that really do seem to anticipate the ways that prayer will come to replace sacrifice. That's already biblical. And this is one of them. Ye'erav alav sichi, may the words of my mouth, right, bring pleasure to him. Another one, of course, is Psalm 19. Yu l'ratzon imrefi, may the words of my mouth be a source of, may God take pleasure in them, right? Just as ratzon is a term used for sacrifices. So I think that's really interesting here. The last verse lands a little bit like a clunker to a lot of modern readers, right? What is this doing here? All of a sudden, may sinners depart from the earth? I think what we are forced to surmise here is that what the psalmist is thinking about is this creation and its ecological harmony is so perfect that I don't want anyone to disturb it. I don't want disturbances. The world works. Don't mess it up. Don't mess it up with sin. Don't do that. This world is good. It's whole, right? It works the way it's supposed to, unless you choose to get in the way. Get out of the way. One day, may people who get in the way be moved out of the way. And I think that's what's going on here. It's making a very profound point, which is, harmony is fragile. Humans, one of the other ways they might be different is, they have the capacity to ruin it for others, right? And so in a funny way, that verse feels so ecologically contemporary to me, so powerfully speaks to this moment. May those who set about undoing the harmony that governs the world, may they be defeated. May they be, in the very violent language of this psalm, may they be disappeared, if you will. Brown's comment on this verse, which I really, really appreciate. The great move of the conclusion of this psalm is to say that humans, rather than sea monsters, are the real purveyors of chaos. Humans are the real purveyors of chaos. And Brown sort of further notes that his appreciation of this last verse is that without it, someone cynical and jaded, someone say like Butch Pemstein, someone cynical and jaded might say, right, this is simply a rose-colored, sugar-coated, sentimental poem. And the last verse makes you realize, here's a brutal reality check. We could mess this all up. I think there's something really kind of wondrous about that. But I'm going to ask you to turn to the passage in your packet from Clinton McCann, who I've already mentioned a couple times. And I gave you a long excerpt from his Psalms commentary. I thought some of you would enjoy reading this kind of more slowly on your own time. But I wanted to just look at a couple of sentences that I think are interesting. And again, just sort of throw our crisis into a light that is very unusual and very unconventional, certainly in the more kind of secularized communities that many of us inhabit. And I use the word secularized there even to include communities that are in lots of ways explicitly religious, but that the kind of the discourse is not so theological. So at the top of page 4, thousands of years before smog, acid rain, and global warming and the so-called butterfly effect, the poet who wrote Psalm 104 was an environmentalist. The psalmist knew about the intricate interconnectedness and subtle interdependence of air, soil, water, plants, and animals, including humans. Of course, the psalmist's awareness was grounded not in etymology, not in a knowledge of physical sciences like botany, zoology, geology, hydrology, and meteorology. Rather, the psalmist's awareness was grounded in theology. I love this. I think this is such a beautiful reading of this text. The psalmist was convinced of the profound interdependence of air, soil, water, and all living things because he or she believed that everything derived from and was ultimately dependent on God. Nature, as we often call it today, is not divine, but it is sacred. It does not and cannot exist apart from God and God's renewing breath. Because for the psalmist, we live in God's world, it follows that everything we do has an effect on God's world and thus on God. Ecology and theology are inseparable. And then comes this claim that I think is so radical for, and again, you know, what I described before as radical subversive in a kind of secularized time. Taking the psalmist as an example, we would have to conclude that that concern for the environment begins with praising God. That's the sentence I wanted to invite you to sort of reflect upon. Concern for the environment begins with praising God. It's like, you know, imagine someone getting and saying that at an environmental policy meeting, right? To be sure, this sounds hopelessly simplistic, scientifically and technologically naive. But such a starting point and its underlying conviction that the world belongs to God is the only thing that will dislodge our arrogant assumption that we can save the world as if it were ours to save. Psalm 104 affirms that God has made every arrangement and provision for the life of the world. The only problem will be if someone disrupts God's design and destroys the delicate balance God has put in place. For the contemporary world, verse 35 may be the key verse in the psalm. Paraphrase a famous line, we have seen the wicked and it is us. Now, I don't know whether McCann, this is probably 30 years ago, would still say the same thing about just getting out of the way as opposed to intervening to reverse a lot of what we've done. But I think the thrust is nevertheless the same, or at least largely the same and significant. And then again, the last sentence here that I underlined, the environmental crisis will be addressed by nothing short of praising God, exalting God, and humbling ourselves. So let me just very quickly say, as always, what I wanted to do is study Torah with you. But I wanted to also just sort of kind of elicit a few observations. I was sort of interested in the question about whether talking about, thinking about, and ultimately praising God can make us feel obligated rather than entitled, which is a default thing I think so many humans in the modern world have come to feel. I wanted to explore the kind of different but interacting ideas in Tanakh of solidarity with, community with, and yes, also responsibility for the rest of the created world, and to think about the idea that the world may be many things, beautiful, glorious, harmonious, terrifying, difficult, impossible, breaking, but that one thing the world is decidedly not from a biblical perspective is ours to use up or destroy. It is many things, but it is not ours. We are guests, gerim atem, right? You are guests here on this earth, not its owners. And finally, one of the many things we could have talked about but didn't, and this in a way is an image from later tradition, is that part of what it means to live covenantally is to have in mind what we bequeath to our grandchildren in terms of the health and flourishing of Torah, but also the health and flourishing of the world and the earth that they will inherit from us. And that, at this late date in history, ought to be a very, very sobering and hopefully motivating thought as well. So thank you all for kind of taking this ride with me, if you will.